Hello, and welcome to Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, a discussion of progressive issues of faith and action, coming to you in the 75th anniversary year of WESU, 88.1 FM Middletown, and at WESUFM.org, and repeated on UConn's WHUS 91.7 FM stores and WHUS.org, UConn's Radio for the People. I'm Maria Johnson. Not just progressive-minded, but sensible Catholics around the world, especially those of us with fond memories of having been taught by nuns, have cause to do the happy dance, as last week Pope Francis effectively called off the dogs who've been hounding that most selfless Catholic population. He met with the Leadership Conference of Women Religious for nearly an hour on Thursday, and the good sisters came away convinced that he totally gets them. This is a big change from the Inquisition of a few years back, when the Vatican objected that the sisters don't spend enough time and energy railing against same-sex marriage and abortion, and instead are always whining about such inconsequential problems as poverty, while they, by the way, also busy themselves for no money running hospitals, schools, and charities. So our good Pope Francis said, leave the nuns alone. I'll post on the ReasonablyCatholic.com blog an assortment of links to the best news and commentary about the Pope's actions. Francis just keeps on giving us reasons to love him. And you can expect an episode of Reasonably Catholic on this subject in the near future. Today, though, we have another timely topic of interest, the spiritual life of Abraham Lincoln, 1 week after the 150th anniversary of his assassination. We'll talk to my good friend, Lincoln expert Frank J. Williams, a retired Rhode Island Supreme Court Chief Justice, about how Lincoln's melancholia built his character. And finally, I'd like to invite you to make a contribution to WESU during this its spring pledge drive. Yes, WESU is affiliated with a fancy university, but the station receives minimal funding from Wesleyan, which is what affords the station the freedom to pursue its non-corporate freeform mission and allows a program about progressive Catholicism, of all things, to air at all. So please do your part to support this unusual programming. The money is very conscientiously spent on equipment upgrades and the like, and nobody's getting rich, believe me. There are a few modestly paid staff members, but otherwise we're all volunteers putting our shows together for the pure love of music, and in my case, giving voice to otherwise unheard Catholic points of view. I hope we can count on you to go to WESUFM.org to contribute whatever you can. Thanks. Back in a moment with Justice Williams.
You're listening to 88.1 FM WESU Middletown. Alternative radio from the heart of Connecticut since 1939.
Many dogs and cats spend endless days indoors staring at the wall, living for the moment when you will come home and tell them you love them, take them out, and make a fuss over them. Dogs and cats need physical exercise and mental stimulation, things to do and think about in order to be healthy and happy. Please set time aside for them and give them a real life and real love. For more information, please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals at 757-622-PETA or helpinganimals.com. That's helpinganimals.com.
Anybody here see my old friend Abraham? Can you tell me where he's gone? Oh, he the good they die young. I just looked around and he's gone, gone. Anybody here?
Welcome, Chief Justice Williams. Thank you so much. I know you are even in your retirement too busy to be doing this. I'm particularly interested in Abraham Lincoln's interior life. What do you know about that?
Well, it depends on what level, at what level, because in the end, as transparent as he was in his public life and as a lawyer and politician. He was a very private person, and he and almost enigmatic, holding cards very close to his vest. So you don't know what all he was thinking about or planning. And that's why the study of him remains so fascinating, even after 16,000 books and pamphlets have been published about him. But if you're asking about his mental state or acuity or lack thereof, he was what we would describe today a clinically depressed. And he called it melancholia at the time. They certainly didn't have the science we have today, or psychiatrist or psychologist that could help, or the medicine that do help people who suffer mental illness. Yet, the thing about him that's so great is that he was able to work through it, and through discipline and the help of friends and family, become or continue to be effective and do a great job at what he was tasked to do.
You know, it seems like even superlatives like great feel like understatements.
Yeah.
You know, there is just no question about that.
Right, right.
How far back did his melancholia go?
Well, we know that it went back to his early years, which were, let's say, early 20s, 21 to 29, in New Salem. That's the village that he settled in after he left the family home in Decatur, Illinois. New Salem is about 30 miles northwest of Springfield, Illinois. Some of your listeners have been there. It's a recreated village. And that's where he, we think, fell in love with Ann Rutledge, who was engaged to another man who left for a long time, and they were very close. We don't know how close, and she died, we think, of typhoid, and he was absolutely beside himself with grief. And his neighbors, and it was a very close community, probably no more than 100, 125, really worried about his physical and mental health, that he might even hurt himself. And they provided companionship and maternal care, and let him live with some of the people that resided in New Salem until he was able to overcome this grief. Then we know when he was engaged to Mary Todd while he was a lawyer in Springfield, about 1840, and he broke off the engagement, probably thinking, and I'm being glib here, probably thinking that she was too good for him. He had 1 year's education in Blab schools in southern Indiana and Kentucky, and she was well-educated into high school years at a private school in Lexington, Kentucky. Mary Todd was very politically astute, and it's one reason why Abraham and her got along so well. She grew up on the lap of Henry Clay. He was a great leader in our political system. And but he broke it off and was very taken back by his emotional reaction, and his friends did worry about him. He was a state legislator at the time. He hardly ever attended sessions of the Illinois House of Representatives, and until he was able to overcome this grief that he had.
The grief over having broken off.
Having broken the engagement with Mary Todd. He broke the engagement, not her.
Yeah.
But about a year later, friends brought them back together, and the rest is history, because in the following November, they were reunited and joined in marriage.
This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU 88.1 FM Middletown, providing community radio that matters, and rebroadcast on the University of Connecticut's WHUS 91.7 FM Storrs, UConn's radio for the people. Today, 1 week past the 150th anniversary of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, we explore the great man's spirituality
with Lincoln scholar Frank Williams, retired Chief Justice of the Rhode Island Supreme Court and a major collector of Lincolniana, who regular listeners may recognize from our tribute to the late, great Mario Cuomo, Chief Williams's friend and co-author. If Lincoln lived today, the chief says, he might have been diagnosed with clinical depression and treated with drugs. But back then, his dark moods were called melancholia, and he was treated by neighbors and friends, keeping a close eye on him whenever those dark clouds would gather. Chief Justice Williams shines a light on this aspect of Lincoln that was so much a part of his character. Back with the chief after this.
My name is Father John Baptist Pesch from Holy Family Monastery in West Hartford. I think this is a great contribution to what the church is supposed to be at all times, but especially in our day when we're emphasizing more and more the church as the people of God. It's a wonderful program, and I'm glad that Maria Johnson, she took the challenge up when she recognized that there were certain voices that were not giving the proper impression of the way Catholics should respond to the realities of life in the political and social order. I'm in favor of this, even though maybe sometimes I hear things that I don't really approve of. So what? I mean, nobody has a monopoly on what the church is. I encourage you to really to support this by your prayers. We always say that and we mean it. But I also mean this, any kind of a sacrifice you can make to give to the program is well worth it. And I really hope that if I disturb your conscience a little bit, I hope you'll make the most of it. Thanks a lot.
So we pretty much pin his melancholia to that early loss of a girlfriend. We don't know that it existed before that.
That's right.
And what kind of information is there about whether he believed in God, say, or went to church?
Well, he certainly went to the Baptist church that his parents subscribed to in Kentucky, and then when he left on his own, he didn't go to church, and he didn't have a formal religion that he would adhere to. And in fact, when he ran for the Congress, he ran against a Reverend Peter Cartwright, who brought this out in his campaign material, until a denial of Lincoln being a non-believer was necessary by Lincoln.
Interesting.
And he did a handbill that we passed around to the voters that, you know, it is true, I don't belong to any formal church, but I do believe in a divine providence, in divine will, and that there is a maker for all of us. And that's as far as he would go. But I think, Maria, not to jump forward, I think that that sense of there being a God increased with the pressures of war and the politics of a divided country. And you see that in his Thanksgiving proclamations and in state papers. And it reached its ultimate, I think, impact in his second inaugural address on March 4, 1865, which the sesquicentennial of which we just celebrated. You know, here he is saying, almost like an ancient prophet, that the sin of slavery belongs to the North as well as the South. We both suffered for it. The cruel war came. And he quotes the Old Testament, the bondsman's 250 years of unrequited toil. And he doesn't do a victory lap for the Union or exoriate the South. He reaches out for the people to practice God's will of peace and reconciliation. So this has come to fruition shortly before his assassination, which would occur 41 days later.
I have so many thoughts.
interesting how his faith may have increased with his struggles. It's a wonder that his faith didn't decrease with his struggles, you know? I mean, you could really see him going, whoa, there can't be a God. This is too awful.
I think he certainly reflected on that, but I think basically he was a hopeful man. Thank God he got us through the war.
Yeah.
As successfully as one can in a civil war with 750,000 deaths. That's equivalent to 7.5 million using today's population and that ratio. But I think he wondered about the divine providence, whether there was one who existed that would allow this kind of tragedy and casualty count.
Is there any evidence that he prayed his way through?
We see evidence of that, of his being on his knees, anecdotal, of course.
From people who saw
it. Not so much from him, from visitors in the White House, the Executive Mansion, as it was called, and his own correspondence of praying. So we know that he certainly did.
So he would say in a letter, I pray for your...
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
What are your thoughts about him on this anniversary?
Well, it's like losing a friend, really, and that a man that had so much leadership and was so unselfish and had those qualities like character and political courage and resilience and empathy for other people. That we lost all that in this. I don't think I could ever forgive John Wilkes Booth or his insanity for thinking that somehow the South would be saved, the Confederacy would be saved by taking the life of the President of the United States, all the states, not just the Northern states.
This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU 88.1 FM Middletown and rebroadcast on the University of Connecticut's WHUS 91.7 FM Storrs. This is an interview with retired Rhode Island Supreme Court Justice Frank Williams, an expert on Abraham Lincoln, talking about Lincoln's spirituality and also depression as we mark the 150th anniversary of his assassination on April 14th, 1865.
Hello, this is Arthur Myers, director of Russell Library in Middletown, and I'm very happy to participate in this effort to bring greater awareness of WESU to the area. During a week, if I can listen, I am especially interested in Reasonably Catholic because of its breadth of participation of various people. I was on it myself. On the weekend, I'm especially listening to some of the alternative music or music that I wouldn't ordinarily listen to, whether it's from different countries or certainly younger recording artists. Otherwise, during the week, if you're able to listen to it, you have such wonderful programs in the morning as the Diane Rehm Show, you have Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, and those kinds of programs that are just plain broadening for anybody. And I urge you to both continue to listen and support WESU. Thank you.
No one knows what it's like to be the bad man, to be the sad man behind blue eyes. No one knows what it's like to be hated, to be faded, to telling only lies.
I'm just wondering, have any scholars or writers tried to do a revisionist view of John Wilkes Booth? He does seem pretty inexplicable.
Well, also, yeah, and also unforgivable.
That's what I was, yeah.
But You've got authors that are doing the counterintuitive thing about this DeLorenzo, who teaches in Maryland, who believes that Lincoln was really the cause of the war, and that it was it could have been avoided, and you know Lincoln was the one who developed the strong Federalist system that we quote suffer end quote with today. And
sounds like a Tea Party guy.
Right, and the you know the it was all a matter of economics, and he's received a lot of press on this, but it just doesn't equate with the very broad shoulders that Lincoln had, and the fact that his hand was on everything, Maria. It was on not only the war and the military operations, but the politics of governance and things like supporting the Homestead Act for people to settle in the West, to the Morrill Act, which created the land-grant colleges, to the Transcontinental Railroad, the expansion of our country. I guess some people today resent that, but it was, I think, bound to happen, and it did, and he had a part in that.
Mm-hmm. This writer doesn't go so far as to say John Wilkes Booth was within his rights.
No, and it's very hard to find someone who, if anyone, who has said that.
Yeah.
And I've got to bring this analogy. I mean, there are apologists for the internment of the Nisei, the Japanese Americans that were almost 200,000 of them placed in those camps at the outbreak of World War II. There are apologists for that, but most think it's a stain on our history.
So it comes to mind because you're saying there are people who will defend the most indefensible thing.
Right, right.
But so far, nobody who will say John Wilkes Booth did the country a favor.
Correct.
Right.
Well, unless, and I don't want to disparage anyone of our country, our fellow citizens.
Oh, go ahead.
As well as North, but I'm sure there are some diehard Confederate nationalists who feel that Lincoln deserved the death like Mussolini and Hitler received. And I say that in a talk on the assassination, which I give, that the mourning for Lincoln after his death in April 1865, April 15th, that's Holy Week, deserved it. I mean, clearly then there were those, and some of the mourning for him was really artificial and not genuine or sincere.
Wow.
So I think that some of that may continue to this day, but
yeah, because there's loopy people everywhere and every time.
Well, it's true, and this senseless violence that we continue to do or have is evidence of that.
So, at the risk of getting into spooky and possibly silly areas, what about these legends or this lore around whether the assassination was kind of fated or predestined or that there were premonitions? Do you know what I'm saying?
He did have premonition of death, of being on a barge going to the other shore, of going down, a dream of going down into the East Room and seeing his reflection in the mirror and grieving people around a beer and asking who was that, and saying it's the president who's been murdered. So he did have, I'm paraphrasing of course, but he did have this premonition, or at least two that he spoke about.
Were there death threats? I imagine there were.
Oh my God, by the bundles. In fact, he only had 2.5 secretaries. One was borrowed from another government bureau to help John Nicolay and John Hay, and they would try to intercede and keep him from seeing death threats. But some got to him, and he had a cubbyhole in his desk with those that he had read and kept.
Wow. Really?
Yes.
I mean, that would inform one's dreams.
Yeah, yes, and he thought, you know, he would not accept security when offered by his Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, who worried about his health. He did have a cavalry escort that would take him from the White House to the cottage on the grounds of the soldiers' home on the edge of Washington for him to relax and get away from the humidity of downtown Washington. And sometimes he would ride a horse himself once his hat was shot off.
Ooh.
And there were kidnapping attempts that were foiled only because of a change in schedule. And they were led, at least two, by John Wilkes Booth. And when he couldn't kidnap them, that's when it turned to murder. And so the Washington, D.C. police officer Parker, assigned to protect him on April 14th when he went to Ford's Theater to view Our American Cousin, left his seat outside of the presidential box and went down to a bar next to the theater and had a couple of drinks and then wound up with a prostitute for the night, shows up at his station the next morning, and only then learns about the death of the president, and nothing really happened to him. It was maybe a short suspension, and he was back on duty. And there was no secret service. There was a secret service, but they were not assigned to protect the president and other government officials. The secret service, which was part of the Department of the Treasury, was strictly for counterfeiting. And now they were morphed into Homeland Security. That's where they are now.
What about Mary?
Well, I want to say what about her, but I'm being silly. What area?
Well, she really went around the bend after the assassination, right? But even before that, she had issues, we'll say.
Yes, she did. And even her most sympathetic biographer, Jean Baker, calls her neurotic. She could be neurotic.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a lot of sympathy for her. She's not a warm and fuzzy person. She could have these temper tantrums even with Lincoln. Not with the kids so much. They really spoil them rotten, doted mm-hmm. on them. But the fact is that they were, at least until the White House days, of a very close marriage. Maybe because he spent 3 months in the spring and 3 months in the fall riding the 8th Judicial Circuit and was away from home a lot. Mm-hmm. But I think it was a good marriage. They had four sons, but I think there was a kind of estrangement brought about because of the war and how time-consuming it was for the president and commander-in-chief. They didn't chat or matriculate as much during the Civil War as before,
mm-hmm.
and she resented that, I think, and rightfully so. But it's understandable, and she had her quirks. Her spending habits were sometimes out of control and more than the budget and salary of the president would allow.
Mm-hmm.
And refurbishing the White House when they first got there in 1861. Was an example. They overspent a congressional allowance by about $8,000, and when Lincoln heard about it, he was furious because the country was stretching resources to buy uniforms and weapons to fight the war, and Lincoln would have an outburst. And how could I stand for this expense on flubdubs, using his word?
Mm-hmm.
And the government allies found a way to get the $8,000 in the budget to cover the over expenditure by her, so that there were these issues using getting money from selling items from the White House garden, and colluding with the White House gardener for cash, getting cash from selling. These are rather sordid.
Yeah.
But in fact, it happened. So there were problems here.
This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU 88.1 FM Middletown, providing community radio that matters, and rebroadcast on the University of Connecticut's WHUS 91.7 FM Storrs, UConn's radio for the people. You are listening to an interview with retired Rhode Island Supreme Court Justice Frank Williams on how depression helped build Abraham Lincoln's character. Stay out of harm's way. Stay out of harm's way. Oh, how I pray that just stay, stay out of harm's way.
You think Sally Field did a good job of portraying Mary in the movie Lincoln, and that the movie holds up for you altogether, pretty much.
Yes, it does. You do have the artistic license, of course. For example, Lincoln never slapped Robert, who wanted so much to join the Union Army, and his mother was against it for fear of losing him too. He had already lost two siblings, his Eddie Baker in Springfield was about four, and Willie, who died in the White House in February 1862, who was most like his father. And the mother, of course, and the father were very concerned about Robert. So he got him a job with General Grant as an assistant adjutant to see the end of the war. Robert had just come back from Harvard, having finished there, and he wanted to see some of the war. And Lincoln is shown in the film of slapping his son in somewhat of retaliation for Robert's wish. That never happened. And little things like Mary and Elizabeth Keckley, her dressmaker, being in the gallery of the House during the debate on the 13th Amendment resolution.
Yeah.
Women weren't really allowed in the gallery. Little things like this that are irksome. But I think as far as presenting the tenor of the discussion and the tenseness of whether or not the 13th Amendment should be finally passed by the House and sent to the states, I think that's very true. Lincoln using very political means to garner support for a high, noble end, which is final freedom.
Mm-hmm. Well, since we're talking about the movie and popular culture, I guess, are you familiar with Bill O'Reilly's book, Killing Lincoln? And
I am. I've read it.
What do you think?
Well, it's great narrative, but really more than Spielberg's Lincoln and Tony Kushner's screenplay, it's just so silly and stupefying on the number of errors it contains.
Interesting.
And I have a friend who wrote a book on the assassination, Blood on the Moon, Ed Steers Jr., which is a wonderful book. He did a 32-page list of errors in the book. And all the irony is, Maria, all that O'Reilly and Dugard, his co-author, had to do was to send the manuscript to one of the assassination experts, Lincoln assassination experts, which is like a subset of Lincoln scholarship, and they would have gladly vetted it for them, and probably not even charged for it. But how do you stand in the way of an avalanche? It was on the bestseller list for over a year.
I mean, I don't know. I don't know how to explain that.
I guess it's part of our culture as far as, you know, this knee-jerk reaction to...
Did he have a political point to make by these errors?
say again?
Do you think these errors were in the service of some political point?
No, I think they were just silly.
Just careless.
That's what I tried to point out, that they really didn't do anything for the book. And if it had been corrected, I don't think it would have taken away from their story.
This is part of a series, right, on killing this one. And I mean,
It became a Killing Kennedy and
right.
And killing Patton. And,
I think he did Killing Jesus.
Right.
Aye.
Right.
As if Jesus hasn't suffered enough.
Exactly.
Wow. Well, is there anything that you think people should understand about Lincoln that they don't? Is there anything you want to help us, maybe having to do with the assassination or anything?
Well, I think there are some general precepts here that really operate, especially in our very contentious culture. We still are a house divided, as Lincoln called us in 1858 when he accepted the nomination in Illinois to run against the incumbent Senator Stephen Douglas. That we need to be more discerning, civil, stand up for what we think is right, but also be able to mediate differences. He was mediating cases, Maria, before that word was ever popular or coined,
mm-hmm.
even as a lawyer. And the fact that I mentioned earlier with you, these character traits that he had of courage, political and otherwise, of resilience, which could be also willfulness, but willfulness for good, and empathy. I think if we look at him in that light, or look at ourselves with those characteristics as the paradigm, I think we would do a lot better as neighbors and as a nation.
Amen. From your mouth to God's ears.
Well, one can only hope. Which is Rhode Island's motto, as you know.
Hope, yes.
Hope.
You know, you came across my radar, not that I'm not always thinking of you, Justice Williams.
I understand. It's been a long time since we even saw each other after you left Rhode Island.
Right. But I heard you speak on the subject of Lincoln's depression to a group of medical-minded National Guards people here in Connecticut. And one anecdote that you told has kind of lodged in my brain, and I'm wondering if you'll repeat it. It's just an image of Lincoln as a young man in this little town where people were keeping an eye on him because of his known proclivity to be blue, to say the least, depressed. And of him walking out into the woods with his gun.
Yes, and he was not a gun person. And it would never, he killed a wild turkey, which was certainly common in the day for food and sustenance. And after he did that, he felt so badly that he never killed an animal. And he was also against bullying by peers.
And we see this in his writing?
Yes, and also the fact that this gun incident was when his neighbors in New Salem, after the death of Ann Rutledge, feared for his safety with his going into the woods with a weapon. Now, there was also the same concern by his Springfield neighbors years later with the disengagement with Mary Todd, and some would take away his razor, his straight edge razor, for fear that he would hurt himself.
Wow. Had he, now it's coming back to me, that poem that we believe was written by him suggests that he was wrestling with suicide.
That's correct. The soliloquy where he talks about the person, obviously him, taking the steel, as he called it, and doing the final deed.
This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU 88.1 FM Middletown and rebroadcast on the University of Connecticut's WHUS 91.7 FM Storrs.
Hi, I'm Nick Ingala, spokesperson for Voice of the Faithful. We value the opportunity to get the word out, so we're grateful to WESU-FM for airing the type of programming that makes people think hard about Catholic issues. Please support this station by giving whatever you can.
Back now to our interview with retired Rhode Island Supreme Court Justice Frank Williams on aspects of Abraham Lincoln's personality that, if he lived today, might be viewed as clinical depression.
Do you feel like this deep depression bordering on suicidal depression, did it affect his personality and his cast of mind in a way that bore fruit in some concrete ways? You know what I'm saying?
Well, I think it's a very good question, and one could speculate, and I would like to think, if anything, it increased his empathy for other people who were suffering.
Yeah.
Either physically or mentally, and those who were in harm's way, the soldier, south and north, and why people related to him, that he understood. He understood their wants and concerns and their hurts. I think it accentuated these feelings. Plus, his fortitude in focusing on mission and task and overcoming that malaise, that melancholy, and getting the job done.
Yeah. You, in a way, then, it's related to his character.
No question.
Interesting. I mean, really, if he were alive today, and we can talk about whether he'd even be elected to be dog catcher if he was around today.
Correct.
And we should talk about that, by the way, the way people look at mental health issues as some kind of character flaw and making them unfit. But
well, that was the point of the paper with these people, too, right, that it needn't be. If Lincoln can overcome this, even without medical assistance, without pharmaceuticals.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Today, a doctor would put him on Prozac.
Exactly, or something similar. He would be a candidate. And I think most psychiatrists, if not all, agree that he was, based on the case history, clinically depressed.
And all through his life.
Yes.
As far as we know, starting with
that.
Yes. Yeah.
I think, too, Maria, this is why humor was such an antidote to him. And he was a great storyteller. He learned that from his father, who was kind of not a ne'er-do-well, but really never did aspire anything more for his son, Abraham, than being a farmer and cabinet maker, which Thomas was. And Lincoln wanted to leave this and get away from this and, utilize what we call the right to rise in our culture. But Thomas was a great storyteller, and Lincoln picked that up and would make many points by telling stories and releasing his own tension and stress. You see this in the Spielberg movie, too, where he not to everyone's liking, like some of his cabinet members who thought it was foolish, but to Lincoln, if not to others, it was medicine of a sort.
Hmm. Yeah, a lot of humor is born out of pain.
Yes. Yes.
I think any...
Because when you think of the alternative, we're in trouble.
Yeah. I mean, he just grows in my estimation every time I talk to you.
Well,
I realize, wow, what a really superhuman person he was.
He was a good man.
I mean, how did he even get through it all?
That is the question.
Could there ever be a Lincoln coming out of our culture today?
I don't see it. I'm sorry to say, I would love I would love to, for that to be the case. I think most Americans would. And yet we have a system, both in election, nominating and electing our presidents, that dictates against it. The primaries, the amount of money that's spent in creating a presidential candidate. Also, I think the pressures of the world, the global village in which we live, also make one wonder whether there shouldn't be two presidents instead of one, in view of the almost indomitable task of leading.
Like a domestic and an international?
Yes.
Wow.
So
I never heard anybody say that before.
But
that's
it's
a
not
new
going
one.
To happen under our Constitution, of course, and I don't expect that to be changed anytime soon, but I think it's a very real issue, and just the demands on one person, regardless of what party or who that person is.
What would it be like for Lincoln? How would he approach things?
Well, the way he did everything else, by digging in, and because there were international crises at the time he was president, but not like today with the threat of terrorists and nuclear, chemical, and biological warfare. But I think he would be certainly au courant about it, and it would deal with it in the way he dealt with Civil War, with a toughness and humility that would make us prevail. And if certain civil liberties, as occurred during the Civil War, were necessary, he would do it, like suspension of the writ of habeas corpus, the precious right to have your detention checked. So I think he would do, hopefully, with the support of most of the people, what he thought was necessary to overcome the obstacles and difficulties that we all confront today.
Mm. Yeah, but you know, just on the basis of physical appearance alone, he would never get anywhere.
Well, that's what Ken Burns says, who did the Civil War documentary. I don't know. I'm not so much concerned about the way he looked at 6'4", this lanky, stooped figure. I'm more concerned about getting the message to the people and having them respond, and what would resonate with our people, our citizens today.
Do you think he would make use of all kinds of social media?
Sure. I mean, because, you know, he was writing letters that to people that he intended to be picked up by newspapers, and they did, and we had the telegraph then, which really helped on instantaneous or almost instantaneous communication.
How do you know that was his intent?
Because he would send cover letters with some letters that he intended to be republished and reread, and said, well, you know, make sure this gets out. And, you know, he's telling them to get pamphlets made of them, and like his letter to the Corning, this reply to Erastus Corning on why the military tribunals should be used in this kind of war, and the reasons for the suspension of habeas corpus, and, you know, if someone forces a soldier boy to desert by speech and by action, shouldn't that person be arrested or detained? I mean, this is what he was saying.
Yeah.
So this got out. I mean, this Corning letter, we call it. Just 100,000 reprints of this,
wow,
if not more.
Wow.
So that's what people did in those days. They would do the letter. They would have it republished. They would also, the political party would also publish it in pamphlet form and distribute it free or for a penny or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
This is this because Lincoln recognized that public sentiment is everything. That's right out of one of his debates with Douglas. And that's why he was able to get reelected with 2,200,000 votes for him and 1,800,000 votes against him in 1864, when up until the victory in Atlanta, Georgia, and Mobile Bay and the Shenandoah with Phil Sheridan, we were losing the war and losing the morale of the people.
Yeah.
And so he was thinking loss, but he was able to pull it off because of these victories. But
yeah.
Now, think of it. He still had almost 2 million people disagreeing with him, right?
Right.
Disagreeing with his, with the war policy. And so this is how close we came to losing the war and losing him as a president.
Wow. Well, we only have a few minutes left, and I know you have an important appointment right now. So I just want to invite you to say anything more about Lincoln and his spirituality, or just, you know, I feel like even though he wasn't a Catholic, he's a saint.
Well, I'm a Catholic, and I consider him a saint. In fact, I told one of my bishops when I was mediating a case with the diocese that if I were to sit with Jesus Christ on one side, I wouldn't want Abraham Lincoln on the other, because he belongs there, you know, in our memory and in our actions. And this is why we commemorate the 150th of his death with not just fanfare, but I think with reverence, not to be curt about it.
How will you mark the day?
I think just thinking about it, but going about my duties and work as a mediator here, and I don't think there's any better way of celebrating him than trying to bring peace among people.
Ah, that's lovely. And I know from my experience in your courtrooms covering them as a reporter that a bust of Lincoln is never far from your elbow.
I'm looking at one now in my chambers, one of several. So he's always there with me, even if I didn't have the bust.
Well, I know he's proud of you.
Well, thanks, Maria, and again, we need to get together.
Let's figure that out.
All right, until the next talk, which might be on Appomattox, did it really end the Civil War?
Oh, is there a question about it?
Yes, because there were still armies in the field, and we like to have wars neat, right? A beginning, a middle, an end, and look what happened there on civil liberties, civil rights, and Iraq, Afghanistan, the whole shimoli. With maybe the exception of World War II, right?
You're something else.
So we can talk about that.
All right, take 1 minute.
What's
I just
that?
Had one more thought.
Yeah.
Because I don't have a grip on what your collection is like. Just say a word about the kinds of Lincoln. Do you call it memorabilia? That you
Lincolniana.
Lincolniana.
Just
okay.
Add a I-A-N-A to the end.
Okay.
It's hard to pronounce, but... So I started when I was 11, in the sixth grade, buying used Lincoln books, really pulp, for 25 cents. That's all I had for lunch money. And I used it to buy Lincoln books, and then it grew from there, and we have a pretty extensive library. And then you buy ephemera and other material like statuary and prints and philately and numismatics and...
Wow.
Ads and clippings and all other things that relate to Abraham Lincoln.
Just name, by way of example, one or two of your favorite finds.
You mean in the collection?
Yeah.
Well, they're in a bank vault, but the signed copy, presentation copy of the Lincoln-Douglas debates, which he had published in Columbus, Ohio.
Wow.
Even though he lost the election, he was proud of the debates and his performance in them, and it did make him a national figure because of his competing against the little giant, Douglas.
Right. Yeah, that's
pretty
good.
And I think the one thing that I like currently is hanging in my chambers. I'm looking at it now, and it is the official... A certification by the then Secretary of State of Rhode Island, Bartlett, on Rhode Island passing the resolution of the 13th Amendment after it came to all of the states. And Rhode Island was the second state after Illinois to ratify.
Wow.
So someday we'll give it to the state. We bought it at auction. I don't know how it ever left the state, but
yeah,
someday we'll present it back, but not till after I'm playing with it a while.
Gosh, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
All right, Maria, and don't be a stranger like before, okay?
You got it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was an interview with retired Rhode Island Supreme Court Justice Frank Williams. And that's all for this episode of Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith. Don't forget to check out the blog, reasonablycatholic.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Maria Johnson.